You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
People say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. Any white is just proper. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the real deal.
Okay, so like...
Hello, Mr. Everett. Cassius Green here. Sorry to bother you.
I mean, you got it wrong. I'm not talking about sounding all nasal. It's like sounding like you don't have a care. Got your bills paid. You're happy about your future. You're about ready to jump in your Ferrari out there after you get off this call. Put some real breath in there. Breezy, like, I don't really need this money. You've never been fired. Only laid off. It's not really a white voice. It's what they wish they sounded like. So it's like what they think they're supposed to sound like. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Retro Movie Podcast, the podcast where everything is connected. I'm your host, Jacob Thompson, and joining me is my friend, co-host, and the most person most likely to get a can thrown at his head, Alex Perkins. Perk, how you doing tonight?
I'm good. Luckily, today I dodged any cans that were thrown at my head.
You aren't not wearing any head bandages for the rest of the podcast?
No, not today.
Maybe we'll see that next week. But yeah, welcome back to the podcast, everyone. This is the Red String Movie Podcast, where every week Perk and I review a movie that was connected to our previous one. Last week we reviewed The Harder They Fall, and our connection was Lakeith Stanfield, one of our favorite actors, to get to this week's movie, Sorry to Bother You. As always, you can find our show on Friday mornings on podcast services. If you like it, please share it with your friends. But let's get into it. Perk, intro this movie for us.
Yeah, all right. So Sorry to Bother You is a 2018 joint directed by, I think, directorial debut of Boots Riley, starring Lakeith Stanfield and Tessa Thompson. Lakeith Stanfield, notorious longtime friend of the show.
Yeah, I was going to say he was a friend of the show, but we're fans of him on the show.
Right. and it's about a down on his luck dude living in his uncle's garage who gets a job telemarketing and gets a tip from a friendly old man to use his white voice. And in this reality, his white voice is David Cross. And he just shoots up the ladder of capitalism and stomps on his homies on the way up. And then, you know, shit goes awry.
That's one way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any fun facts you want to?
Sure. I have a couple. Mainly just little funny tidbits. The voice in the elevator was Rosario Dawson. And the first Equisapien, the one who broke Lakeith Stanfield out of the car, was Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah, I didn't tag either of those people until I looked at the cast list. I was like, oh, shit. Rosario Dawson, Forrest Whitaker, goddamn.
Yeah, just funny. Mm-hmm. lots of people in this movie.
Yeah, and it's very stacked cast, honestly. And I'll go first and see, this is one of your favorite films. This movie, so like obviously going into it, I heard it was weird, and you had told me many times you're not ready for this movie. And I'm like, okay, I get like, I know it's going to be weird. And I thought I knew what area of weird is going to be. Because like, there's the whole bit at the beginning where when he's on the phone, he like drops into people's houses and it's like, hey, he's actually talking to them.
Yeah.
That's going to be like that kind of weird. Then I expect to see horrifying horse people in this movie.
Right.
That was quite the turn. But yeah, I really liked it. I think it's a very, very smart satire on capitalism. And also race, but it's mostly about capitalism, honestly. Like, there's racial commentary in this movie, for sure. But it's mostly, yeah, like a satire on capitalism. I think it's very well done. I think it loses a little bit of steam after the reveal, because that's such, like, a insane moment. Then you're kind of just, like, chilling for a little bit, and then the movie ends. But I the thing I like the most of this movie is just the world they've created, this kind of alternate reality that's very different but very similar to our own. It just has weird little things in it that aren't really explained a lot of time. And I just really dug that. I think it was really well, like, conceived and produced.
Yeah. So I love this movie. The first time I saw it, you know, I was enjoying it, right? Because the message I can relate to is pretty, like, unequivocally, like, billionaires are horrible, shitty people. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely love all the scenes talking about worry-free, which is essentially just rebranded prison. Like, you sign a contract, you never have to have wages anymore because you have, you know, all your food paid for, your housing paid for, in literally a prison with some nice paint, and you just work in a labor camp for the rest of your life. But there's security in that, so.
Mm-hmm.
No, and we even see, like, his Uncle Terry Crews, like, I don't know, man, I'm just talking to worry-free people, like, not the worst idea, but.
Well, because that's how punishing capitalism is and can be for certain people. In this movie and in real life, mostly minorities, you know, which we see. Like, I'm pretty sure every person he calls is white, except for, I guess, the head of the cell phone manufacturer in Asia. But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of meat there to like, dig into.
But, yeah, so a lot of times, sometimes movies will have a plot twist in them that catches you off guard. This movie has a plot twist that punches you in the face.
Mm-hmm.
It, like, just you aren't prepared. You're just watching along. There's a weird guy in a bathroom stall, and then holy shit, horseman, full dong exposed, like right out of there. And it is actually a little bit foreshadowed. There's some little funny bits throughout the movie where on rewatch you'll see there's hints and clues. There's a lot of thematic horse stuff going on.
Well, I noticed that when he did the quote-unquote coke off of the plate in Armie Hammer's office, there was a horse on there.
Named Bobo, or Bobo the horse or something.
And I saw in the facts, actually, he has, like, all the paintings behind him are, like, different horse paintings. So, yeah, like, it's definitely foreshadowed. But, yeah, I mean, it's such a wild twist, but, like, once it's explained, it does make sense within the world they've created.
Oh yeah, it's like the logical next step. Like, we've got all these people captive and forced labor. How could we do better? Well, why not just turn them into horse people so they can work harder? Like,
And that gets exposed, and the stock market's like, "Yep, we like that. Good job."
That's one of the. There's so much shit in this movie that's just funny because it's like, oh yeah, that probably would be the case.
Yeah,
but yeah. The fact that what's Lakeith Stanfield's name? Cassius. Cash. The fact that, well, yeah, his name's Cash too, which just another Cash Green. Little thing in there. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he reveals that they're turning people into horse hybrids, and then all of a sudden, like, everyone's like, "Yeah, look at that! Like, medical history is being made." It's
believable. Boy, my favorite quote in this movie, easily, is when that happens and no one gives a shit, and he goes to talk to Steven Yeun and his friend, who I'm blanking on, at the restaurant or whatever, before they try to stop the line. Yeah, Jermaine Fowler. And he's like, "What? Like, no one gives a shit." And Steven Yeun goes, "You know, people see a problem they don't know how to fix, so you just get used to the problem," which is such a relevant thing right now, especially with, like, Ukraine going on. It's like, yeah, this fucking sucks, but there's nothing that we can do about it. So you have to get used to the problem, and then you, like, start not caring as much over time, right? We get used to these things. And it's weird. Like, the movie's not old by any means. It came out in 2018. It's like 4 years ago. But it felt so relevant. Like, even more relevant than when it came out. I really liked all the commentary in this movie. I think it was really well done.
Yeah, the themes running through this whole movie are just so on point, and everything has, like, a through line. Even, yeah, like we said, the horse twist sure catches you off guard, but like you said, it makes sense, and it's, like, earned within the narrative. Like, it is a logical conclusion of what they're doing. So the fact that it's way out there, but still, like, fits the verisimilitude of, like, the super billionaire character
Yeah.
It's really cool. Yeah. Not often do you get away with a left turn so hard like that, but...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It does work.
And like I said, I do think it does lose a little bit of steam, because then it's like, Cassius finds out and he exposes it, then it's like, okay, now what do they do? You know? Right. And then we eventually get, like, the picket thing and movie, you know, kind of concludes or whatever. But, and I'll say, too, just say now, I think what the first horse person we saw, I think, was... There was some CGI on it as well, but it's mostly practical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I'm so conflicted because I'm always pushing for more practical effects, but some of these didn't look great. It was good enough. Like, it didn't really take me out of it. But there, like, some of the shots of them, I'm like, those look fantastic.
I think that the practical nature of the effects makes them a little just more off-putting, you know? Like, CG tends to smooth things out, so... If you have just someone with just like lumps of clay all over them to make them look like a horse, it's really disturbing, and it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, their mouths don't really move because they're freaking horses. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You can explain it away however you want, but I agree with you. Practical effects are a lost art in a lot of movies.
Yeah. But yeah, as mentioned, there's a lot of just very weird stuff in this world that it's honestly never really explained. Like, for example, when they're at a bar at one point and Danny Glover's shown at the bar with them and he's like, "I'll give me the good stuff." And she opens up, like, the inside of a whiskey bottle to find a smaller thing of, I'm assuming, like, higher whiskey. And then I'm like, is that ever going to get explained? And nope, that's just part of the world. There's just, like, a little hidden shit.
I think... Some people could potentially see that as a bit of a drawback, that there's a lot of stuff in this movie that just feels like the directors thought, oh, you know what would be cool here? Mm-hmm. Like the scene where he's on the phone telemarketing and physically drops into people's houses. It's really cool, but it's never touched on again. It
doesn't go anywhere, yeah.
Yeah, it's just kind of it's a motif, like a little tidbit in there, so... I like that kind of stuff. I like weird out-of-the-box shit, but I could see that maybe someone thinks that's a little... just kind of pulls you out of it a little bit, but...
Yeah. Yeah, that is one thing that I wish they would have had a payoff for, or that would have gone somewhere, because that was a really cool concept to do, but he did for a little bit, and then never came into play again. So that's something I would have seen a little bit more. Another thing that I'm not sure how I feel about is the whole left eye group, because... I'm like, okay, they're the left eye, there's like the black mark, but then Mr. Bleep has an eye patch over his left eye. Is he connected? I was like trying to draw shit all in this movie, and we also, like, the left eye thing totally just fizzled out. Like, that never amounted to anything. And like, Tess Thompson was like participating, which was cool, but that, again, never really amounted to anything. So it's just like, it was a cool part of the world, but I wish it had been a little bit more payoff.
Yeah, the left eye group kind of just seemed more like a passive character. I agree with you. I think if it had been a little more involved, because... The final strike at the end is with the union, not, like, the left eye.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's just more, yeah, like a passive presence. But I had not even considered that Mr. Bleep has a left eye patch. Which, actually, that ties back into what I was just talking about, where his name is Mr. Bleep, but, like, why? Like,
yeah, there's no reason for that.
No, like, his name is just literally, like, bleeped out in the movie, which, again, like, I have no problem with. I think it's kind of cool, but it seems like something that was just in there because it's kind of cool. Or maybe I'm too stupid to understand why. Most likely, well, like, that's the case, but...
That's how I felt during Tessa Thompson's art thing, where she had people throw stuff at her. I'm like, I don't understand the symbolism here. I'm trying. I do not get it.
I thought that scene was hilarious. She's just, like, standing up there reciting shit, and people are like, well, I guess I gotta throw stuff at her.
Yeah, I found that scene just very strange. I mean, because I was trying very hard to figure out what the fuck was going on.
And that, a lot of this movie is, like, you can't really think too hard, because it doesn't go anywhere. Nothing makes any sense. So.
Yeah. I had two, like, really big predictions that did not end up happening.
I'm curious.
So the very beginning of the movie, when Cash and Detroit are just, like, talking in bed, and he's, like, at scene about, like, what happened, like, what if we die, or what if our people we love die, and all this stuff. I thought for sure he was going to get to, like, the height of, like, greed, and then Tess Thompson was going to die in a freak accident, and that was going to, like, snap him out, which granted is like a pretty well-worn trope, so I'm kind of glad that didn't happen. But
sure.
I'm like, I thought that was going to be what got him out of it.
So you're telling me that when he was contemplating life with Tessa Thompson, you thought she was going to die, not he was going to get turned into a horse.
That is correct.
Okay, just...
yeah, make sure you got that.
Checking that one off, yep.
And then the other thing I thought I was very confident in was, so when Armie Hammer is pitching him on the whole horse plan, and he's like, I want you to be their MLK, I want you to like be their ally and be like, oh, we're going to unionize. I thought that was totally foreshadowing for Steven Yeun being that guy. I thought like, oh, did Regalview hire Steven Yeun to like be their guy on the inside? No.
Oh, okay. No.
Which, I don't know. Maybe I'm trying way too hard, but I'm like, these parallels are there, and then that is amount to nothing.
I'm going to use this jump-off point to talk about, well, the acting, obviously, but specifically Armie Hammer. Oh, my God. He could not have been more perfectly cast.
Oh, God. Especially with recent news.
Yeah, as the billionaire weirdo guy. No, and, like, often, you know, when I say I laugh at something in a movie, it's like I breathed a little harder. But, I laughed out loud when... Cassius runs into the horse people, and then they go back to his office, and he's like, wait, just wait, watch the video, it'll explain everything. And then they do this weird claymation video, and it just says everything, and it's everything we pretty much already know. And he's like, see? It's like, what do you mean, see? He's like, I just wanted you to see that I'm not crazy. It's like...
Yeah, it's like, there's a logic.
Yeah, because clearly this guy's delusional and thinks that he's all, like, right of mind. And I think that's, you know, billionaires always think they're in the right, even if they're ridiculous. So the fact that he's like, oh, clearly I'm not crazy. Look at this video. And the video's, like, crazy. So.
Yep.
That little claymation bit by the, like, fantastic, by the way.
Oh, yeah. It was very, very well done. Speed of Armie Hammer, too. I really liked how, like... stereotypical he was to Cassius. I'm like, oh, you're from Oakland, tell us some gangster shit. And he's like, I don't have anything like that. He's like, oh, but you can rap though, right? And it's just like, that stuff is just so just classic white people. Oh, and then when his
the rap
is just saying the n-word over and over again, and I'm like, white people fucking love to say the n-word in songs, dude, because they're like, oh, it's a free pass to say it. And it was just like, that was the best commentary right there on the race,
just like a full fleet of white people all yelling the n-word back at him. It's just so funny, too. Yeah, because his rap sucks, then he's like, what do these white people want to say, like, or want me to say, so.
Yeah, man. It was great. Also, speaking of the claymation thing, the other part that was similar to that was when, I love how they shot him upgrading his apartment and stuff, of, like, the lamp, like, kind of, like, breaking in the new lamp, forming the TV, like, folding, and that was all really well done. I think it was kind of, I think I read that was, like, similar to the claymation stuff. It was kind of an homage to that. So that was really cool. There's a lot of just really cool little tidbits in this movie. And like you're saying, maybe some of them should have been explored more or less. But it was very interesting to watch. Like, you cannot deny that.
Yeah. Like, I could hear the argument if someone says, like, all that stuff takes you out of it or something like that. But when so many movies nowadays just stay in the lines, like, okay, sure, he doesn't really go anywhere, but he's zigging and zagging all over the place, you know? Like,
yeah,
I appreciate that eclectic filmmaking style, even if it's not entirely, like, fluid, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'd much rather this movie exist than not exist, right? Even if it's not perfect, I don't think it's a perfect movie. It's trying so much stuff that something's going to hit you or inspire people to, like, do more of this kind of stuff. So
definitely.
Yeah, it's great.
But yes, we talked about Armie Hammer. Maybe we'll touch on the rest of the actors. I think pretty much everyone was amazing. Stanfield kills it as the lead character. Tessa Thompson's great as his foil, kind of. And Steven Yeun and... Jermaine Fowler are also great in the supporting cast.
Yeah, and I really like Steven Yeun. He was so good at playing that, like, trying to be Mr. Steal Your Girl kind of role, like, but still, like, trying to be good. Like, I think he absolutely nailed his role.
That guy, man. What a come around.
I think he's still underappreciated.
I still gotta see Minari. Maybe we can get Minari in on like a foreign language string or something.
Oh yeah, we'll get that one for sure.
No, like, and not to be forgotten, because all the acting's great, but you can't sleep on the voice acting.
Mm-hmm,
because it's just so perfect. Like when you think of white guy voice and it's like David Cross, it's like, oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then when he gets up to the power caller area and runs into Mr. Bleep and it's Patton Oswalt, come on. Like that's exactly who you would expect it to be. It's perfect.
Yep. Yep. And so, and honestly, like they're like, I didn't really realize until after that those were different voices. I thought they were both David Cross. They sound similar to me. But yeah, absolutely perfect. I love that. And I like two things. One, that the other characters acknowledged that it was like overdubbing. It wasn't just they nod like, no, this is like weird. But the other thing is I really liked how Danny Glover characterized the white voice. Because I had seen the trailer, I'd seen like part of that conversation, but I didn't have the full context. And I thought it was just going to be like, oh, like talk like a white person. But no, it's like, no, you talk like all your bills are paid and you're carefree. And like basically like talk like you have the life that a typical white person does. Or at least that they think they have, right?
Yeah.
And I love that. I really like that characterization of it because it's not just like a pure race thing. It's like, no, like let's look at the differences between these two races and then use that to inform this aspect of the world. Very, very cool.
Apparently, I don't remember this, but Detroit was also had a dubbed British voice.
Yeah, when she was at the art gallery.
Oh, okay. That was Lily James. So
I saw that.
Yeah.
That's something, too. I mean, I noticed it from the subtitles. It was like Detroit in white voice, but it was her being British and stuff. But like,
sure.
I kind of wish they would have acknowledged that because she called out Cash for using his white voice too much, and then she was just using it. Also, they were like surprised he was able to do that, and then she was just able to do it. I was like, I don't know. I kind of wanted a little bit of like acknowledgement that she had a white voice, but they just kind of let that, you know, slide.
Okay. I was just checking too to see if Danny Glover's white voice was anyone, but it seems it wasn't.
I think it's David Cross also.
The internet tells me it was a sound engineer.
Oh, all right. There we go.
You need to get better at picking out David Cross's voice.
Yeah. Last thing I want to make sure you mention is the picture he keeps with him always changing.
That's really funny. See, there's another
fucking
thing.
Fucking love that.
Yeah.
Love that. And they never explain who that. You assume it's like his dad. You know, it doesn't
probably
really matter
his dad, yeah.
Who it is. It's like a person that he cares about. And then they're always the person being like, you're doing great or you're fucking up. And I didn't notice it for like probably too long that it was changing.
Yeah, I think. Is it every time he looks at that picture, it's a different pose?
I think so.
Yeah, it's just another thing where it's like, why is it doing this? I don't care. It's cool. You know? I hope I don't contradict myself for some other times where we watch a movie and I'm like, this is stupid. Maybe. I suppose context is everything. So.
Yeah. I just want more stuff in this world, you know? Like, I hope Boots makes another movie that it's like very in the same universe or a very similar thing, because it's just fascinating. Every little bit of you're just like looking for stuff that's weird or slightly off. Yeah, it's very, very cool. Anything else you want to touch on before we go to recommendations?
And I like, there probably is, but that's pretty much all I got. There's just so much in this movie you could pick apart, but yeah, I dig it.
Yeah. Watch this movie, people. My recommendation based on this, though, if you like it, particularly the capitalism commentary, I'm going to go Squid Game. Pretty recent show that a lot of people watched, obviously. But if you haven't seen Squid Game, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. That also tackles capitalism by inventing this very weird situation that's not normal but makes sense. It's kind of like even in Sorry to Bother You, the game show of like, I got the shit beat out of me. It's like, yeah, we've gotten to the point where people will pay or get paid so they can get the shit beat out of them. Like, it's pretty dystopian and fucked up.
I forgot to even mention. I love that. Game show, I got the shit kicked out of me. That's hilarious. Yep. Like, and definitely like another natural progression. Like, people will do anything to get on TV. I guess I'll get the shit kicked out of me.
Or for money. I took it as like people need money so bad that
that's
they'll
it,
go on the show and get the shit. Like, and that's what I guess Squid Game comes in. That's all Squid Game is essentially. So anyway, if you like that kind of stuff, I would highly recommend Squid Game.
Yeah, so my recommendation based on this film is Squid Game. Definitely didn't rip that off Jacob. No, honestly, like, I can't really think of anything that's even close to this. Like, you're right.
I know.
Like, Squid Game super fits thematically. But, like, I don't think Boots Riley has any other, like, feature films. And
no.
So there's nowhere else to bounce off that. But, like, I guess if you like the actors, bounce off the actors, check out whatever else they're in. But, yeah, this movie's wild. I can't really tie it to much else.
Yeah, it's very singular and unique. But yeah, that's our review of Sorry to Bother You. Please check it out. It's on Netflix right now. Okay, so for bonus reviews, Perk, you got a lot. So I'm gonna do all mine first, and then I'll let you go off on your tangent here.
All right.
You're doing your Oscar breakdown.
Hell yeah.
Before that, I got two movies for you that I watched this week.
What do we got?
Number one, I went to go see the new Jujutsu Kaisen Zero movie. This is another anime movie, very similar to the Demon Slayer movie that came out. I know you watched, Perk.
So it's like a canon movie?
It's canon, yep. It's nice. A canon. It's a prequel to the first season. So if you've heard of Jujutsu Kaisen and you've been interested in it, or if you really like the Demon Slayer movie, go watch this movie. You know, it'll give you a tint of the world, and if you like it, I'd say you watch the first season afterwards. MAPPA, the studio that made it, is just a fucking class at fight choreography. They're doing the current season of Attack on Titan right now too, and they're just popping the fuck off right now. Their animation is gorgeous, and how they shoot action is so awesome. This movie didn't hit me as emotionally as hard as Demon Slayer did. There's not really that much depth to it, but it's a really, really cool story. It's got more horror elements than other anime you might see. There's some really creepy stuff in there. But yeah, it's like a super solid action movie, really fun characters, got some humor in there. Yeah, go check it out if you want a fun little anime movie. Second movie I watched, Perk. Have you seen Les Miserables?
I have not.
Okay, so here's the dealio. I watched a little musical called Tick, Tick, Boom, and I loved it, right?
All
right. I told my friend, and I'm like, you gotta watch this. She's like, okay, I'll watch it if you watch Les Miserables, because that's her favorite musical.
Sure.
And I'm like, you know what? I like musicals, and I've heard this one's very good, so I'll give it a watch. And I watched it, and I'll tell you what, Bert. I now understand why you don't like musicals.
I wasn't sure where this was going, but all right.
Here's the thing. I consider myself a musical fan. I love Mamma Mia. I love Tick, Tick, Boom. I love La La Land, all right? And the reason I like them is because there's talking, and then there's singing. You know, we talk to get through plot stuff, and then we sing for emotional moments or character moments. I did not realize that Les Miserables is 95% singing. Like, the entire movie is singing. Even this, like, normal plot conversations that need to happen to move the plot forward, they're singing them. And I'm not trying to say the movie is bad by any means. It's definitely not. It's just not for me. To praise the movie, production design, outstanding. Like, this movie got an Oscar for makeup. And totally deserved it. Like, the sets and the outfits, everything absolutely incredible. And I'm a person who hates period pieces, so that's saying a lot. Number two, performances are fantastic. Anne Hathaway absolutely deserved the Oscar she got for supporting actress. Her rendition of I Dreamed a Dream, insane.
For her 5 minutes of screen time or whatever it was.
Dude, she deserved it. Like,
that is generally what supporting actors or actor turns into. It's like,
yeah, I mean, she got an Oscar for the one scene of the song, and she totally deserved it. Absolutely incredible. Hugh Jackman, fantastic. All the performances and the singing is good. So many things in the movie I don't really vibe with. I don't love the genre of music. It's pretty much kind of like opera-ish singing. The plot moves like way too fast and way too slow at the same time. Like, the plot itself moves too fast, and then the songs just repeat themselves a lot, and I get kind of sick of them. I don't understand the passage of time in this movie at all. Like, Anne Hathaway's character, minor spoilers, she gets fired from her job, and then it seems like the same day she becomes a prostitute, and then it seems like the next day she dies. And I was like, this happened very quickly. Was there supposed to be, like, it's implying there's a 2 week or month gap? Was she down being a prostitute for, like, years? I just have no idea. There's no way to tell. Maybe I'm just being dumb, but time moves way too fast at points. The ending I did not like, and granted, this is adapting a book from, like, the long-ass time ago by a French dude, so I'm not saying it necessarily holds up or needs to hold up because of that, but...
Well, it's also probably more an adaptation of the stage play.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think it suffers from... I saw the original cut of this movie, they wanted it to be like 4.5 hours, and it's less than 2.5.
Oh, is it really? I was going to say, yeah. I thought it was like 3 hours.
No, it's like less than 2.5 hours, I think it suffers. Like, because like I said, moves way too fast. You're like, what the fuck's going on? I think if I knew more about the French Revolution, I would have gotten more of this movie, but I don't remember history. And I could have used some, like, paragraphs at the beginning of, like, hey, here's what's going on. And at the end of, like, here's what happened after. I just have very little context for France at that time period. I don't know. There's just a lot of things that didn't work for me and not really my vibe. And like I said, I'm not trying to say it's a bad movie, but it was not for me. So I don't think I'll watch it again. Not going to put it on my musical list. But, yeah.
Fair enough.
That's Les Miserables for you.
All right. Well.
All right, Perk. Give me this full breakdown.
Yeah, so I'm here to do the inaugural version of a segment I'm calling Perkins Oscar Spectacular. Or
let's do it.
POS for short. basically, I don't know. It might change in the future, but I made my way through all of the Best Picture nominees this year. And I'm going to kind of give you my breakdown, my ranking, as well as I'll touch on the acting awards. But I'll explain why it's a little difficult, later. So,
and sorry, when is the Oscars again?
Oscars is this coming weekend, the weekend, I think it's the 27th or 26th of March.
Oh damn. So we're going to watch it live.
Yeah. So I had to get these in under the wire. I watched 4 movies this week, counting Sorry to Bother You, one of which I had to go see because for some reason Licorice Pizza is still in theaters, despite the fact that I think it's been in theaters since December. So,
yeah, see, we gave it a long-ass time ago.
Yeah, but I went and caught that one in Uptown. So, but yeah, all right. So on that note, let's kick it off with number 10. I've got Licorice Pizza, number 10.
All right, yeah.
It's a Paul Thomas Anderson film. It is beautifully shot. Fantastically acted. The lead actors are Alana Haim from the band Haim and Cooper Hoffman, son of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep. They're both really, really good. But the movie essentially revolves start to finish. It circles around a blossoming relationship between a 25-year-old girl and a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah, I can't do that.
And it's just at a base level, it feels really weird and kind of uncomfortable in scenes. So, a lot of the people in the film are based on real people, but it's just an uncomfortable setup, and I have to, obviously context matters, but I have to like think, imagine if the gender roles were reversed and someone tried to tell the story. It'd be unacceptable. But yeah, aside from that, even the movie is far too long. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes long, and it has almost like a bunch of episodes. Like, Sean Penn shows up, and he's in a couple scenes. Tom Waits is also in those scenes. Like, Bradley Cooper shows up, and he's in a couple scenes. Like, he's pretty well advertised on the trailers, but he's only in about 10 minutes of the film. There's Ben Safdie, the director from Good Time, Uncut Gems. Yep. He's in a couple scenes. Like, it feels just kind of like a chain of events. Like, a lot of just things happen. And the through line is this weird relationship. So, Licorice Pizza, great peripherals, weird at a spinal level.
Right. Would he have suffered if he was 18?
I think it still would be a little weird, but I think if maybe she were 19, he was 16, 17, you know?
That's still weird, though. If you're crossing the 18-year line, and that's where things get really tricky.
It's still odd, but I think if it were a little bit... like a little closer of an age gap, it'd be less ridiculous. I suppose
15 is so young.
15 to 25 is
that's
really out there.
I'm not even 25 yet.
I know it.
All right. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So that's number 10. At number 9, we got West Side Story, which is down this low because I am who I am and I don't like musicals. So once again, it's really well directed, really beautifully shot. The lead acting performances are fantastic. I quite often tell myself that I don't really like Ansel Elgort, and every time I see him in something, I'm like, oh, I'm wrong about him. He's great. And I'm blanking on her name, but the lead actress, it's really not good. I should have stand up a little better.
Is it Rachel?
Yeah, it's Rachel something. I'm looking it up for due diligence.
Rachel
Zegler. Yeah, she is really great as well. This is not a story I knew, so the story's good. Yeah, even like the supporting actors, like the two heads of the gangs are really good, but lots of long dance scenes, lots of like soliloquy song sequences, and once again it's over 2.5 hours long and drags for me. So
yeah,
not all too much bad to say about it, but it's a musical and I like La La Land and that's about it. So number 8, we got King Richard, which is the story. This is funny because those are the three movies I watched this weekend. It's almost like I left them to the end.
Usually it's recency bias. Usually that bumps them up.
But. You'd think, right? But yeah, I think I left them to the end because I wasn't particularly excited to see any of them.
Sure.
King Richard is good, all right? So none of these movies really suck. Like, yeah. King Richard
I mean, they're Oscar nominated, so I'd hope not.
Well, you never can be sure. Yeah. I think Suicide Squad 2016 won an Oscar.
It won for fucking makeup.
Right,
that's
right.
Fine.
Fine. Yeah, King Richard is the story of Serena and Venus Williams growing up, mainly Venus Williams and their dad, Richard Williams, trying to get them in, into tennis clubs and train them up and get them where they need to go. And Will Smith's great. He's really good. He deserves his Best Actor nomination. The lead, or the girl who plays Venus Williams, really good. Girl who plays Brandy, his wife, really good. Serena Williams is a pretty minor character, but her actress is good. But the movie kind of boils down to a long sports-type movie. Like, the way it kind of comes to the end, like, through the climax, is like the big game. So, at the end of the day, it just kind of feels like another sports movie. But with there's more nuance to it. Like, he's a pretty nuanced character. I feel like it's a little bit glossy about Richard Williams.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about.
But I don't know. There's the
whole thing of him, like, abandoning his previous family.
It is briefly touched on in an argument he has with his wife.
Okay.
But yeah, no, they essentially just put that in there as like, oh, see, maybe he's not as cool of a guy as you think.
Right. Well, I also found it kind of strange. Maybe this is me being, I don't want to undercut the role of their dad in their life, but I would have thought this movie would be called like the Williams sisters. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like it would be more focused on them than him, but maybe I'm being unfair.
So it certainly is the story of Richard Williams, but it only picks up when Venus and Serena are like already, you know, tennis players, and it just follows the journey from them from Compton to big tennis pro tour. So it's a smaller snippet, but Will Smith is very clearly the main character. So I don't think it's mislabeled, calling it King Richard.
Sorry, I don't mean to say it's mislabeled. I mean, like, I would have preferred to see a movie that was, yeah, it should have been about them and not him, but maybe I just mean.
The story is actually, it's really interesting. Like, he's a very interesting character. So, I mean, like, he had a plan laid out for them to be professional tennis players before they were born. Like, it is really that weird. So I think it's okay to tell that story. I wouldn't be upset if down the road we see a like Serena Williams solo pick, because this movie really doesn't touch on her at all. All these events
really
are,
that's really surprising.
Yeah, so all Venus is the older sister, and so all the events are kind of following her, because she really did kind of pave the way. Serena kind of came in the aftermath. But yeah, like Venus was the first to turn pro because Serena was still young at that age. And so yeah, that's something I didn't know either. You know, like we see them, we think, oh yeah, they're doubles partners. They're both really good. So they must have just like
come up at the same time. Well, and Serena honestly has more of the spotlight.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's a quote in there which must be a real quote. There's no way they would have put it in there either, anyway. But after the big game for Venus, Richard tells Serena, Serena's going to be number one, but you're going to be the best there ever was. Mm-hmm. Which, if it's a real quote, is really cool. I'm always sus about those things, but I think they were consultants on the project, so if Serena Williams says that happened, then it did.
Yeah. Last question I have for you on this movie. Sure. How was John Bernthal?
He's awesome.
I fucking love John Bernthal.
Yeah, he's really good. I mean, he's only in about the back third of the movie. He's the coach they finally settle on. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But no, he's good. I mean, he's just goony tennis coach guy down in Florida, and like he doesn't have all that much to do, but he does a good job with it.
Okay. If you haven't seen it, one of the best Hot Ones episodes of all time is John Bernthal's.
Oh yeah, I don't really watch Hot Ones, but I feel like I should. You know,
dude, I fucking love Hot Ones. Anyway,
all right. Where are we at? Seven? At seven, I got Don't Look Up. Have you seen that one?
No, I meant to, and then I feel like everyone stopped talking about it, so I'm like, I don't need to watch this anymore.
That's generally how things go. Like, I don't need to watch Game of Thrones anymore, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. It's all about Breaking Bad.
yeah, so Don't Look Up is, like, pretty much a comedy about an asteroid coming down that's going to literally decimate the planet. And it's like a scientist and his doctoral student who, that's Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence. And they find it and they're like, we got to stop it. We need to do whatever we can. And then there's Mark Rylance's Amazon billionaire guy who's like, there's precious metals on this asteroid. We should like segment it, blow it up and catch it. and Meryl Streep as the president and Jonah Hill as her son. And they are the comedic highlight of the movie. They're very, very funny. The plot of it is pretty applicable because obviously, like, you see big meteor coming to Earth and half the planet being like, it's not a big deal. And half the planet being like, we're all going to die. It seems COVID-y, although it was put together and written before COVID. So
I saw that. Crazy.
Yeah, it's really weird how applicable that is. I think that's just kind of how every issue goes. But yeah, it's I think climate change is the main metaphor. It's good. It's not as preachy as I assumed it would be. I mean, it's obviously a little preachy cause it's from like left leaning Hollywood. So
Adam McKay,
but they do take hits at both sides. It's obviously more towards the right. Cause like the title comes from like the, when, you know, impending doom is coming, the president and her lackeys are all don't look up. And the scientists are all just like, look up, look there. Like, there's literally an asteroid.
You could see it, yeah.
They have an Oscar-nominated song from Ariana Grande, which is a little cringe, but... she has a character, and her character is pretty funny. So, like, it works out okay. It's funny. It's pretty cleverly written. I honestly am a little surprised it got a nod. But I'm okay with it. I mean, it's a really good movie. So, which brings me to number six, another movie I am also surprised got an Oscar nod. But now I saw on the line might be a front runner for Best Picture, which actually might make me think less of the movie because I don't think it's that good, but it is really good. It's CODA, which stands for
You praised it last week.
Yeah, Child of Deaf Adults. It's a fantastic movie. It's a coming-of-age story about a girl who's growing up with a deaf family. Mother, brother, and father are all deaf, and she kind of has to be a conduit to them to interact with the world. And she finds a passion for singing and wants to go to music school. And really cute, really well acted, nice story, but like there's like the C plot is, you know, cute boy at school, they have to sing a duet, which for me is not good. I don't like those like cheesy also ran type storylines, but like I really love this movie, but I don't think it's the best picture of the year.
Okay.
Yeah, so if it does win, it's actually going to be a good thing, right? Cuz mm-hmm. I'm curious because the Oscars are a real cynical bunch. I'm wondering if they vote for this because it's representative of deaf people and it has good representation in it. I wonder if maybe they're in for the gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
You never know. Oscar voters.
It's hard.
Really
it's dumb. Hard because like that would be a good thing for representation.
It would. It certainly would. I mean, they won. I think they won best ensemble cast at the SAG Awards, which is really big. Mm-hmm. That's like mm-hmm. the SAG Awards Best Picture,
mm-hmm.
and it's deserved too. All the acting's fantastic.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
All right, in fifth place, Nightmare Alley, Guillermo mm-hmm. del Toro, noir type film. I flip flopped with Coda and Nightmare Alley. I think both really good, both very very different. So it's about a carny turned con man, who works his way through the carnival and then leaves to go to the big city to be like one of those pseudo mind readers. You know, like I'm sensing a lost one in your life, a Jenny, a James. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those kind of guys, grifter. So, not too much to say about this one cause it's hard to explain, but it's really tightly directed, well acted by everyone involved, especially Bradley Cooper. He's really good. I think he probably should have gotten Best Actor nomination, but I don't think he did. Mm. And yeah, I'm a fan. Definitely check it out. I think it's HBO. All right. Cool. Fourth place. We got Drive My Car, which
wow, that high.
Is way higher than I would have ever thought the only Japanese film on the list would have gotten. Because coming in all honesty, I thought Drive My Car was going to be on there because Parasite was so popular that now we should have a foreign language film on there every time. But it's not. It is clearly there of their own merit. It's a fantastic movie. It's a meditation on grief. It follows a play director who used to be a theater actor and him dealing with the loss of his wife, bonding with the driver of his car who's also lost people in her life, and it's really beautiful. It's well worth the 3 hours. It doesn't feel like 3 hours. Give it a watch. We as a country don't give enough credit to foreign language films. So I'd say definitely, like, if you're willing to go on an adventure, give this one a go. Number three, we got The Power of the Dog, which is similar to Drive My Car, a movie that at the start I wasn't sure I was going to like. And then I came around on it as it developed and got way more in depth with the characters. Fantastic lead performance from Benedict Cumberbatch. A great supporting performance from Cody Smith McPhee. A mind-bogglingly nominated supporting performance from Jesse Plemons, who certainly does not deserve a nomination. He's not bad. I talked about this when I saw it. He's not bad, but he certainly doesn't do enough to deserve an Oscar nod. And Kirsten Dunst is spectacular. Beautifully directed, beautifully shot. Really like this one. It's a interesting story that I hadn't heard. It's based on a book, but it's creative to me. You know, original to me. So,
right.
And that one's on Netflix, so it's easy to watch. Number two.
Side tangent from that
one. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Have you seen The Imitation Game?
I have.
It's probably my favorite Benedict Cumberbatch performance that I've seen. He's so good.
I'm not sure he quite outdoes himself with this one, but it's certainly close.
Mm-hmm.
He's in peak form. Yeah, it's
so we talked about when you watched it, like, now he's Doctor Strange. I think people have kind of forgotten how good of an actor he is. He's so good.
Yeah, people sometimes disappear into, like, franchise roles, and you kind of forget. Like, I'm interested to see what Robert Downey Jr. comes up with, you know, now that he's done being Iron Man.
Maybe he won't. Dr. Doolittle, and that was not great.
Yeah, we don't talk about Dr. Doolittle. He needs to go work with, like, a down under director, like
the Safdies or something.
Yeah, work with the Safdies or being like a horror movie directed by like Robert Eggers or something.
I was gonna say Eggers, dude. Northman's not too far away.
I'm too spooked already. Can't do it. But yeah, no. Definitely check out Benedict. He's on his game. Number two, got Dune, which I always forget is nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah.
But I really, really love this movie.
God, the cinematography.
I'm very excited for the next one. No, and some of the stuff they did for like the creating the cinematography where I think they borrowed it from Mandalorian actually, where they do like tan screens around the characters to mimic the light bouncing off sand. Just everything in this movie is super beautiful. The acting is great. The story is spot on the book, save a couple bits and bobs here and there that really don't detract. Mm-hmm. And I'm super excited to see where it goes next. I think Denis knocked this one out of the park, cementing himself as like one of my favorite directors easily. Oh, yeah. So he was already there, but
it better win Best Cinematography, dude. Like I will riot.
It really should. I think there are definitely worthy competitors, but come on, like Dune kicked it out all the way out of the park. And then number one, which is the only movie that actually probably would be in contention with the movies that I actually think are my favorites from last year, which would
I was
be
gonna
like,
say, I'm like, wait a second, I know he likes Macbeth and Belfast. There's only one left.
Yeah, one of those wasn't nominated. Bit of a tragedy.
Yeah.
Do you get that? Did you get that?
Oh, yep, I got it.
Bit of a tragedy? Yeah, I got thank you. No, so my favorite movies that I saw last year were, well, Dune. Dune's on there. Green Knight, an A24 joint. You love to see it. French Dispatch, because I love everything Wes Anderson does. Tragedy of Macbeth, another A24 joint. Black and white, you know, it's got everything I need. Didn't get nominated for Best Picture, which, I don't know. Whatever. West Side Story got nominated for also super tread over source material.
Sure.
But
it's Spielberg, but, though.
Yeah, I think probably Spielberg got him on the list. It's worth it. It is good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I think Macbeth's better. And then, Belfast, my pick of the litter for Best Picture. Just a really beautiful, cute, small and epic story of a boy growing up on a block during the trouble in Northern Ireland. And it's one of those movies where it's told from the view of a child and you can see that. You definitely can. Like there's rioting in the streets and people throwing Molotovs through windows, but if he does good on his exam, he gets to sit next to the pretty girl in class. Like it's just such a beautiful movie. It has a score that really, really fits, despite being by Van Morrison, who sucks. But the score works really well. Perfectly directed by Kenneth Branagh. Really well acted. I think it caught supporting for Ciarán Hinds. Maybe it's Kieran. I don't. Irish names are hard. And Judi Dench should have caught Best Actress. Definitely should have caught Best Actress. And also probably should have caught Best Actor, but people are who they are, so. I don't think the odds say that it's not going to win, but for me it's like a head and shoulders above The Crowd as my favorite movie that came out or my favorite movie on the list of Best Picture nominees.
Right.
And then I'll quickly just touch on the acting categories. Mm-hmm. So best actor, I probably would lean towards Benedict Cumberbatch. The acting categories are weird because there are a lot of actors nominated for movies that didn't get Best Picture.
Interesting.
So I'm kind of just going off of these ones that I've seen. So there's more people nominated. I think J.K. Simmons might be in one of them, and I'm sure he's great. Mm. I'd probably go Benedict Cumberbatch for best actor. Best actress, my pick would be Caitriona Balfe. I don't know how to pronounce that. She's the the mother in Belfast, and she's spectacular. Mm. Supporting actor is a tough one. He did get nominated. My pick would probably be the dad from Coda, who I will find his name so I can do him justice, but he's great. Marley Matlin plays the mother, and she's like the most notable actor in the movie, other than like the hearing actors, like Eugenio Debrez is in it. He's great.
The dad's name is Troy Kutzer.
Thank you. Yes. He's really, really outstanding in this movie. And I think worthy of recognition. And best supporting actress for me is kind of hands down Kirsten Dunst from Power of the Dog. She's outstanding in it.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that concludes the Perkins.
Well, Oscar let me ask you one more question.
All right. You've given
your ranking and the movies that you didn't think should have made it. What is your prediction though? What do you predict will win Best Picture?
So my heart of hearts says Belfast. The odds-on favorite for the longest time has been Power of the Dog, which I think is the most likely pick. Mm. I did just see an article today that apparently the odds kind of have Coda pulling up as like a come-from-behind victory, which I can't really be mad if it wins. I don't think it's as good as those other two movies, though.
Okay, fair enough. And also, just because my category that I care about usually is animated feature film. We got Encanto, Flea, I don't know what that is, Luca, Mitchell's versus the Machines, and Rise of the Last Dragon. Admittedly, I've only seen Encanto of this list.
Okay, so I've seen Encanto. I think just Encanto. I can tell you, so Flea is an animated telling of a story of a refugee escaping from Afghanistan in the 90s to Denmark. And it's similar to like Waltz with Bashir, where it's an animated story that tells like a real tale. I want to see it. I think it's on Hulu. I want to give it a watch because it's going to be really powerful subject matter. But yeah, if you are looking for something to watch, I think this one is pretty hands down for Mitchell's and the Machines.
I was going to say, did Spider-Verse win Best Animated when it
did, came out? To my chagrin. Okay,
then I think. What'd you want over it?
Isle of Dogs.
Dude, get the fuck out of here. Isle of Dogs is great, but the animation in Spider-Verse is incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. That movie's a fucking perfect movie. It's a perfect movie.
No, it's great. It is a great movie, and the animation is the strong suit for sure. But Isle of Dogs probably wins that award in any of the other last 20 years. Because
it's so hard.
Stop motion like animation is all. It's a league of its own too.
I feel like it's apples and oranges. It's apples and oranges.
Yeah, it's honestly, definitely like, apples and oranges, which is why it's too bad that both of them had to be in the same category. But this is Sony Pictures Animation. For Mitchell's and the Machines, which I've heard only glowing remarks.
So. Yeah, I need to watch it. I need to watch it.
I think I've also Netflix.
Heard that Raya is. I think it is. Yeah, I think Raya's actually really good too, but I feel like it's very overshadowed.
Oh, I heard Raya's terrible.
Oh wow! All
right, so yeah, not terrible. I mean, there's a baseline for Disney movies, but I heard it's not good. I heard red is great. The way to go of the two.
Mm. Well, there we go. That is Perkins Oscar Spectacular, also known as the POS.
The POS. Look for a return in like a year if, you know, we're still vibing. We'll still be around.
All right. There we go. Thank you for listening to this extra special episode. Next week, we are continuing on the train by following Jermaine Fowler, to Judas and the Black Messiah. Also, the Keith Stanfield's in that too, but he has a connection already, so we can't use him again.
Yeah.
But Judas and the Black Messiah on HBO Max will be the film for next week. Until then, thanks for watching. Bye.
Bye-bye.